Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the road to New Hampshire and Election 08, a sharp economic populism is in the air in a way it hasn't been since long before Ronald Reagan. The idea that the rich are getting richer unfairly on the backs of the middle class is hot in this campaign. Here's John Edwards.
And what we know is that the corporate power that has a stranglehold on your democracy is not going to give up without a fight.
And it's not just Edwards or Democrats raising the pitchfork. Here's Republican Mike Huckabee, the big GOP winner in the Iowa caucuses.
Our party is sort of getting its groove back. We're finding out how to talk to the middle class, finding out how to talk to people in small business that make up 80% of the jobs in this country, to speak up for the folks that maybe felt like nobody was talking for them and to them.
Now, in the midst of the campaign season, New York Times investigative reporter David K. Johnston is out with a hot new book that reads like a bill of particulars for the populist case. Johnston is a serious reporter who's gone deep and found what he calls a rigged economic system in this country, with Adam Smith's invisible hand shackled by lobbyists and business interests. It's a damning case, and it's a theme in the thick of national politics right now. This hour on Point, David K. Johnston on the rigging of the American economy. Joining me now from Rochester, New York, is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times. His book, Perfectly Legal, which exposed the inequalities in American tax policy, was a bestseller. His new book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. David, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Did you ever imagine when you started out on this book that you would be quite so much in the thick of the presidential political fray?
No, not in the least. Nor did I think when I started looking into these issues some years ago that I would find the things that I've found.
Let's understand your politics for a minute. I mean, did you coordinate with the John Edwards campaign to bring this out just now? Are you strongly Democratic or Republican, or does it matter to your what you found in your investigation?
Well, I'm somebody you would find very hard to classify because I hold lots of different beliefs about things. It is public record because you can go look it up. Mm-hmm. I'm a registered Republican and previously was registered in the Independence Party in New York. But I don't frankly pay much attention to what politicians say. What I have focused my life on for many years is what the government does after the politicians pass the laws and the administrators put the rules in place.
We're going to come to exactly what you found when you looked at what's going on out there. But give us a sense first, with all of your background here, with the deep, serious attention you've paid to how the economy works in this country, what do you make of John Edwards' very angry, rise-up, middle-class America message on the campaign trail? And for that matter, of Mike Huckabee's version, not quite so white-hot, but for a Republican, pretty hot.
Well, I know about as much about it as somebody who simply pays attention to the news. Clearly, both of those candidates and to some degree some of the others have recognized that a lot of people are aware that while the American economy has done fabulously well now for several decades, they are not doing nearly so well. And it's causing people to look around at their circumstances and say, what is this disconnect between the nightly news and the president constantly telling me how fabulous the economy is and my circumstances are not so fabulous?
Is there a connection in this way? When John Edwards says corporate greed and undue influence are ripping you off, middle America, is he right?
Well, I certainly document in Free Lunch, as I did in Perfectly Legal, the incredible outsized influence of what I call the political donor class. If you're an elected member of Congress, you have to devote an inordinate amount of time to listening to the pleas of those people who really are the ones you have to respond to, the people who finance your election and your reelection campaign. And in speeches I've given all across America over the last dozen years, I have said to audiences, call up your congressman's office, tell them you're a constituent, and tell them you'd like to get a meeting with your congressman at his convenience and see if you can get one. I've had people call me back and say that they were asked if they were donors, which, by the way, is a crime to ask that question.
Hmm.
I've had people tell me that when they said whatever their issue was, that they were lectured by a staff member that their views were inappropriate or un-American or uninformed. I've only had one person call and tell me that they actually got a meeting with their congressperson in all those years.
All right, David, give us the heart of your argument. You say something's gone very wrong with the American economy that has twisted it into something quite different from what I guess most Americans alive today probably grew up with, though it's turning into a long time that this new situation has existed now. What's the problem? What has gone wrong in your view?
Well, 27 years ago when Ronald Reagan ran for president, he said government was the problem, not the solution, and proposed that markets would solve our problems. And the voters authorized him and his party to undertake a very major change in the way we conduct government in America and its relationship to the economy. Now, America in real terms, means adjusted for inflation, America is twice as wealthy, more than twice as wealthy as it was back then. Per person, the economy is putting out today about $1.70 for each dollar that it put out back in 1980.
That sounds great.
That sounds absolutely fabulous. The problem is, where is the money going? Incomes in America have largely stagnated. There was some growth in the 90s, but the bottom 90% of Americans' income, as measured by their tax returns, peaked in 1973, and they now get by in about $75 a week less in real terms. That's
the bottom 90%. The bottom 90%. I mean, that's hardly that's way most of the country.
That's what I call the vast majority.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the incomes of those at the very top have gone through the roof. The top 0.01%, that's a tiny group of people, 30,000 people, their income, to get into that group, your income is more than $20 million a year. And this tiny group of people, they'd fill half the seats at a lot of the baseball and football stadiums or less in this country. That tiny group of people makes more than such a large percentage of the income, the top 10%, 1%, 0.1%, and 0.01% now have their largest share of income since the late 1920s.
And what about that growth you described since the 1970s? How much of it has gone into those pockets?
Virtually none. The growth has all been taking place in the top, and the further up the top you go, the more it's taking place. So the question I started examining after looking at that in the book Perfectly Legal 4 years ago was, well, what is going on? If the economy is doing so well, where's the money going? And what I began to see by looking at the rules and the regulations and the court records, and I employed five reporters to help me with this work, was that the government, under the guise of deregulation, had adopted all sorts of rules that allow the government on behalf of companies, and in some cases companies themselves, to reach into your pocket and take a little bit of money from each of you. And I'll give you my favorite example of this. Hmm. When you go shop at many of the new big box realtors these days, and in some cases at shopping centers, whole new shopping centers.
Like Walmart, Home Depot, big shopping centers, okay.
That's right. The sales tax that you pay at the cash register does not go to the government. It is instead used by the merchants to pay the cost of building their store.
What, because the local city council has cut them some kind of break on their way into town?
That's right, because they've said, well, this is economic development and this will bring us jobs. Well, first of all, retail is not economic development. If you want to do economic development, you want to put your money into research, into education, perhaps into manufacturing. But the end of the economic chain is the retail distribution. So on the one hand, when you go to these stores, the money that you pay in sales taxes is not supporting your local schools, parks, police, fire departments. But think about it another way. Imagine that you own Tom Ashbrook's department store down the road.
Okay.
You now are being fully taxed. You're paying property taxes. The sales taxes you collect, you're turning over to the government. And in comes this new competitor down the street saying, well, we charge lower prices or we're this or that way better. And they're getting this enormous boost from the government.
And that's just one example. You've got dozens in here. But you know that what we've been told was, or is, globalization is behind this. If you don't have this kind of ability, the big education, or the ability to do business with China or cut high finance deals, it's your own fault, dear middle class person. You're just not playing the game right.
Well, yes. When you look at what are the causes of this, the White House will tell you that it's education. The unions will tell you that it's globalization and jobs going offshore. There are a whole variety of explanations. My contention is that it is the de facto policy of government to enrich the rich, just as it was the de facto policy of government after World War II up until Mr. Reagan's election, to create and nurture and develop a middle class through the GI Bill, through infrastructure investments, through spending on education and research. And that the government in very subtle ways has shifted this policy, and that's the reason that you're seeing incomes rise at the top. And many of the things I write about in Free Lunch have either never been reported or they have been written about in the language of the people trying to obscure this so that they don't mean anything to you as an ordinary reader or consumer of broadcast news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with fired-up New York Times investigative reporter David K. Johnston. He says the economic populists on the campaign trail may just be right, that the American system has been rigged over the last couple of decades for the rich. His new book makes the case in a lot of deeply reported detail. It's called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Let's get a caller from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air with David K. Johnston.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I heard this gentleman last week on Terry Gross's Fresh Air,
yeah,
and I was absolutely blown away by the things that he had to say. Having said that, for those of us who live in the lower classes or middle class, we know that this class warfare has been going on for decades. It's kind of like driving while black. White people say, oh, that's just your imagination, but unless you're black, you have no clue as to what it's like. But I'm lower middle class. I'm probably poor. I have no problem confessing that, but I know that this has been going on. I see it in our city. They build fabulous new condos and townhouses for the wealthy. They don't build any housing for the lower classes or the lower middle class. They could care less where these people go. So to me, it's a very real thing. And my question is this. Does America as a whole have a problem with coming to grips that, yes, in this country, class warfare does exist, and we need to come to grips with it, and we need to get more people from the middle class up into the decision powers of the government and stop the rich and the elitist corporations from making policies that help them and not us? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank
Jay,
you.
Let us pick it up. David, how about it? We may have skeptics about your message. Jay is not a skeptic, but he's not sure Americans really want to hear this or are prepared to. What do you find?
Well, all societies live on cultural myths, large fundamental stories that may or may not be true. And one of the great myths in our society has been that we heavily burden the wealthiest and most successful people to benefit the poor, especially the undeserving poor. Ronald Reagan's welfare queens driving Cadillacs, who you can drive down the street and see every day, of course. I don't particularly like this idea of class warfare. I think that in a democratic society that there are issues we work out between people. I do want to point out that Warren Buffett says that if there is class warfare going on in America, his class is winning.
And I would have to say, on reading your book, you don't describe this as something that's happening in a vacuum or as a result of a passive upper class. It sure looks like an aggressive effort to grab a big piece of the pie from the top down.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not everyone who is wealthy in America is trying to get the government's rules written for their benefit. There are plenty of passive people among the wealthy, but there is clearly a large, significant segment, particularly the corporate segment, that is very busy lobbying, working behind the scenes in places you never see, And in many cases, people whose reputations are for extolling markets, in fact, have spent their careers working contrary to markets and working to get the government to make rules that will benefit them and sometimes stick you with the expense of their bad judgments.
We're going to get the point by point here in just a second. Let me get a call from Harvey in Rocky Point, New York first. Hi, Harvey. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to ask Mr. Johnson to comment on George F. Will's column yesterday in which he was criticizing people like Mike Huckabee for their populism. He says that economist Stephen Rose, defining the middle class as households with annual incomes between $30,000 and $100,000, Rose says that a smaller percentage of Americans are in that category in 1979 because the percentage of Americans earning more than $100,000 has doubled from 12 to 24, while the percentage earning less than $30,000 is unchanged.
So we're moving on up, George Will says.
That's right. The decline of the middle class came from people moving up the income ladder.
What do you say, David?
Well, one of the things about statistics is you have to be very careful to be rounded about them. You can cherry-pick numbers and come up with all sorts of stuff. Now, I did not read Mr. Will's column.
He went after Mike Huckabee, called him a compound of Uriah Heep, Elmer Gantry, and Richard Nixon. Republicans.
Yes, I saw the headline about it.
Yeah.
I didn't read the detail of it. But first of all, only about 11% of Americans report an income of over $100,000. There's no question that Americans are rising, but you have to adjust the numbers for inflation. That's the important part.
That sounds pretty simple.
When I started out as a newspaper reporter today, would look like nothing, and when you adjust it for inflation, it's five times what it was back when I started out.
David, we'd better hear some more examples here. You give them in great depth. We don't have time for every detail, but in capsule form, give us some examples of the kind of, I guess what you see as manipulation of markets and of the government purse that you see as helping create this inequity.
Well, let's take one of the most boring subjects around, electricity. You turn on the switch and you get electricity.
Yeah.
Enron went all around the country lobbying for laws written for what it wanted, and it won the support of big industrial customers who felt that they were overpaying for electricity and subsidizing homeowners and small business. Half the states adopted these rules, and lo and behold, in those states, electricity prices have gone through the roof, and utilities were allowed in many states to sell their power plants at fire sale prices, not in an open bid to the general the public or any investor, but to themselves by creating a sister company. Those plants have now turned out to be inordinately profitable. In one case in Texas, a group of power plants that was sold for $900 million was resold 18 months later for a profit of $5 billion. And I show the story of a professor at Carnegie Mellon, Suresh Talukdar, who set up an experiment to see if the electricity markets were really markets. Because a market should push prices lower.
That's right.
One of the great insights of Adam Smith. And he immediately found in every way he ran the experiments that prices were driven up to near monopoly levels. Now, that would tell you if you're an economist that there's collusion going on among the sellers. In his experiment, that was impossible because all the trading was done by software agents, by programs high school kids could write.
Okay.
And so these things that are called markets are producing higher, not lower prices. And I'll tell you how bad it is. Just this month, I had a story in the New York Times that the auto companies and their nemesis, Ralph Nader, joined hands to go to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and say these are unjust and unreasonable prices, and under federal law you have an absolute duty to correct this so that we have just and reasonable prices. This is an issue that brings together General Motors and Ralph Nader?
Keep going. Keep rolling,
okay.
David. What else have you got on your bullet list?
Well, let's say you're on an Amtrak train and there's an accident, and it turns out that the railroad engineers are sober, the train is going below the speed limit, the rolling stock is sound. Amtrak has done everything correctly. But the track underneath that you're riding on is owned by the CSX Railroad, the one that used to be run by John Snow before he was Treasury Secretary.
For George Bush,
and
W. Bush, yes.
That's right. And that Mr. Snow, during his years running the railroad, cut spending on safety by $2.4 billion, which of course made the railroad appear to be more profitable and made him a very wealthy man.
So he's a market hero there.
That's right. Well, a police officer was killed on one of these trains in an accident because a fix that was supposed to be made was not properly made for 10 years. Testimony showed that they were faking records and not making proper repairs. And instead of a specially designed cotter pin holding a switch, it was being held together with a rusty nail. And when it came loose and killed this guy, everybody else who was killed or injured settled except the widow of the police officer, who fought for 10 years, got all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
This is about a derailed train as a result of one cotter pin that should have been replaced and wasn't.
And that was part of $2.4 billion of safety savings under Jon Snow at CSX. Well, the jury awarded $50 million in punitive damages. The judges called this borderline criminal behavior by CSX, and at every level they were outraged at the conduct of the railroad. When it was all over and the Supreme Court let the ruling stand, CSX didn't pay a penny. Under a law passed by Congress, they simply handed the bill to the taxpayers, and you and I paid for the costs of Jon Snow not creating a safe railroad for us to ride on the rails.
So interpret that. You're saying that that's an example of a corrupted market that comes around to dun taxpayers for, in this case, Jon Snow's and CSX's enrichment?
That's right, because CSX saved all this money, $2.4 billion, and it put the risk onto you and I. And then they didn't even have to pay for it. So you've created a moral hazard. It's the same moral hazard that you have when somebody feigns having a back injury so that they can collect workers' compensation. Well, those stories are in the news all the time. They are a staple of the TV evening news, the video of the guy building the brick wall who's out on a bad back injury while collecting workers' compensation. But you don't see intense coverage of the kind of case shown here where the railroad behaves recklessly and pays no price for that. Instead, the taxpayers pay the price. What's their incentive to be safe? And by the way, as soon as Jon Snow left that railroad, the new president was giving interviews saying, we're going to focus on safety. We're going to improve the quality of our rails.
So there we are. And another example, but you're saying that when you add up all the examples, and you name names in here, whether it's George Steinbrenner or Donald Trump or George Buffett or, for that matter, George W. Bush and the money that came to him out of a failed oil deal.
Well, no, a little different, Tom, on that one. George W. Bush, who will go down in history as the president who cut our taxes left and right, although Bill Clinton actually gave a much bigger tax cut to the super wealthiest Americans than Bush did. But George Bush owes almost his entire fortune to a tax increase that was funneled into his pocket. And lots of Americans are getting wealthy off of specialized taxes that are then used to fund buying them a building or, in the case of Mr. Bush and his partners, seizing the land of people who didn't want to sell using the government's power of eminent domain and then building, in his case, a baseball stadium, which was with a subsidy of over $200 million.
Now, it goes back, surprisingly, in a way to Adam Smith. This was the hero of Ronald Reagan. He pointed out in The Wealth of Nations and others that the invisible hand, the market, could produce great wealth, and it certainly has, again and again in many places. But you remind us that Adam Smith also explicitly warned about the potential corruption of markets and said, you know, governments, people are going to have to be on guard that they don't get twisted.
That's right. Seldom do people of the same profession gather together, even for merriment, but that the conversation turns to a conspiracy against the public to raise prices, Adam Smith wrote. He then went on to warn that business people will often try to get the government to effectively, in modern language, put its thumb on the scale so that they can earn outsized profits. And all throughout American society, we've had new rules put in place under the guise of deregulation. There is no such thing as deregulation. There's only new regulation and new rules. Everything has rules. And baseball, there's a fun but frivolous activity. Baseball has rules on how much the ball weighs, what color the yarn is, and how many stitches, 104. And the rules I show in Free Lunch have been rewritten to put the government's thumb on the scale on behalf of those who have the most power and money to increase their profits and funnel money out of your pocket.
But are you arguing that somehow the country sort of overshot a happy medium? I mean, I remember those Reagan years very well, and Ronald Reagan was certainly not alone in this country in feeling, unless we were all bamboozled by propaganda, but in feeling that we'd come to have too much regulation, and that it was smothering initiative. Was there not room for some change here that didn't just drop us into a pot of corruption?
Absolutely. You know, government, which is vital to civilized society, can easily morph into something that restrains the wheels of commerce, that creates in our lives a lot of ineffectiveness and inefficiency. I mean, I'm the chairman of the board of a company I own with one of my sons in the hotel management business. Mm. And I am totally annoyed at how much minutia government imposes on us. Much of it I find to be pointless, but that we have to comply with. So I understand these sorts of problems from a very practical point of view. But what happened is Reagan came in and said one thing, and the execution was something quite different. The execution wasn't in many cases free markets, but markets where the rules benefit one side or the other, the removal of customer protections in many cases. You know, we now have ads on national television for loans at 99.25% interest. We used to put loan sharks in jail for charging that kind of interest.
Do you think Ronald Reagan, if you're right, do you think Ronald Reagan thought that this is where his initiative would take the country?
No. I think Reagan was a big picture guy. He was a terrific leader. And Reagan felt that government was much too much in the way. But I don't think that he was somebody who got down and paid attention to the details of how these things worked. And the news media generally doesn't cover the rules and the regulations that keep growing and growing and growing. And Reagan clearly failed in one very key area. He said we should make government smaller. Well, government today is just as big a share of the economy as it was when he came in. And because of deficit financing, we're very close to owing $10 trillion in federal debt. A growing share of your tax dollars are simply going to pay interest on the money the government spent but didn't take in.
And a lot of that spending, you say, ends up having been twisted toward the pockets of the rich. If there was a potentially good initiative here in the Reagan era that got driven off the road, who drove it off the road, David, and why?
Well, a whole variety of people who saw in this the opportunity to enrich themselves or benefit their company. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with pursuing your own self-interest. That's one of the great insights of Adam Smith, that markets work because people pursue their own interest. But if there's no pushback from other people and there's no knowledge, and especially in a world as unbelievably complicated as ours is, where, you know, government regulations come out every day and pages and pages and pages of them on the most obscure small points where one paragraph, one word can be very valuable to somebody out there, that the execution of these ideas then gets twisted by people who have a narrow, concentrated interest in that set of rules.
And that's happened, you write, again and again and again across many industries, with one big effect, which is that shift in American wealth and where it goes, how it gets shared. You hear the same thing we do out on the campaign trail. I'm sure you paid attention when John Edwards was making his pitchfork speeches in Iowa. Do you sense something changing, some readiness to turn this around via Mike Huckabee, maybe even on the Republican side, David, or not?
Yeah, actually, I try to pay very, very little attention to what politicians say. There are lots and lots of reporters, very good reporters, who cover what politicians say. I try to focus very hard on what the politicians have done. So I don't pay a lot of attention to that stuff.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times investigative reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnston. He says in his new book, The Economic Populists Are Right, that the American system has been rigged for the rich. His new book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. And of course, we've heard a lot of that theme on the campaign trail from John Edwards, not least, but others echoing as well. Let's get a quick check-in with the New Hampshire campaign trail, which is white hot right now from Concord, New Hampshire, a road somewhere in or around thereabouts. We're joined by Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
We heard of a lot of economic populism in Iowa. Are the candidates rolling it out again in New Hampshire? And does it sell, Karen?
You know, it's interesting because there are sort of two flavors of economic populism on the campaign this time. On the Democratic side, we've certainly heard that theme a lot from John Edwards, and it's striking that the tone of it is so different from the tone, the sort of positive and optimistic tone that he struck in 2004. And the guy who's really assumed the happy populist mantle this time, interestingly enough, is on the Republican side, and that's Mike Huckabee.
If you've got a Republican, then Mike Huckabee picking up the message, even though it's maybe more mellifluous, a little sweeter sounding. What does that tell you, Karen? Is this something that's really resonating with American voters this time, or are Americans allergic to thinking in these terms that often get called class warfare terms?
Well, it is certainly something that resonated with the voters in Iowa. And, you know, I think the size of Huckabee's victory was much bigger than anyone expected. And the real question is going to be, you know, how well he does as this race moves forward. He's basically here in New Hampshire not because he thinks he has much of a chance of winning, but just because this is where the media is, this is where the cameras are. You know, he wants to ride this wave as much as possible. But I think as this race moves down south, and you do have a candidate who's suddenly very much in the mix, who's talking about his own humble roots and sort of bringing everybody along in this country, I think this is going to be a real test whether there is a, you know, populist strain that has also emerged in the Republican Party. And again, in more of a happy populist sense, not the kind of Pat Buchanan peasants with pitchforks sense.
Happy, but at the same time, tough. It's interesting. David K. Johnston's theme has emerged right in the middle of this campaign. Karen Tumbley with Time Magazine. We'll catch up with you in New Hampshire. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Let's take it on down to South Carolina, where Mike Huckabee, among others, and John Edwards, for that matter, hopes to do well just a little bit down the road. Angel's calling from Somerville, South Carolina. Hi, Angel. You're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have read David K. Johnston's first book, and it actually got me involved in politics.
Perfectly legal on the tax system.
Yep, and in fact, my husband, we heard about the new book the other night on Terry Gross, and he owns a small business, and it's kind of disgusting. He was so mad because for 20 years he's owned a small optical when he's an eye doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to know that these big box stores get to keep their sales tax and get extra money to compete against him when he's cut property taxes and employs people in this community, I mean, it's just disgusting, really. But, you know, a lot of people, if you talk to them about this, they hold their ears. They go, oh, this politician like, say, John Edwards is just angry. They'd rather sit around and feel good with Obama. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I don't, if people don't pay attention, we're supposed to be a representative democracy, and yet no one pays attention to what happens after the election, what bills get passed. So, David, do you see any hope for Americans becoming more aware?
David, there's a question from somebody who lives it, feels it, wants to know.
Yeah. Well, democracy, in order to work, has to have an involved citizenry. And for a whole variety of reasons, including the way I think the news media covers a lot of issues, a lot of people are turned off to politics. They don't want to pay attention to politics and do the work of being citizens. And Americans are not raised to be politically aware. I have found that generally you can have a better discussion about a political or economic issue with the average waiter who serves you in Europe than the average college graduate you run into in the United States, a much more sophisticated conversation. In the long run, there's human progress. But of course, there are the Middle Ages to remind us that sometimes we let good things drift away from us.
We don't want to think in centuries. We've got a campaign going on right now. Do you feel, you say, you look at what they do, not what they say, but do you feel something stirring here, David, that might just respond to the bill of particulars you're laying out in Free Lunch?
Well, the response the book has had so far, and it's been out for less than 2 weeks, It tells me that it's resonated with a lot of people. They've looked around at their own circumstances and said there's this disconnect. What is going on? And in Free Lunch, I provide what I think is the explanation of what is going on that creates that disconnect. There was one thing Angel said I was very struck by, that her husband is a small businessman and he was unaware of this stuff. Now, think about that for a moment. In fact, she's right on the money. Small business people have not been told by their associations, which are busy in Washington making deals with the associations representing big business,
mm-hmm.
They haven't been told about all sorts of government policies that operate against their interests.
So wake up, smell the coffee, pay attention. Let's get a call. You mentioned Europe and how things are seen there. We've got listeners there, and one's on the line right now from Berlin in Germany. Cullen, you're on the air in the USA.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a very brief point about the term class warfare. I don't think it's really appropriate. I come from the United States. I've lived in Germany for some time. The discourse about economics in Germany is just a little bit more transparent. Of course, big businesses, there are big businesses here too, and they have certain tax breaks. But when it comes to poor people's economic interests, I just have the feeling that the media does a lot better job telling people what their interests are and how they get attacked. And I think that's a real weakness of the U.S. media.
I take your point, Colin, but if you follow American politics, you know how quickly that phrase is pulled out when it comes around to issues of equity. Politicians make the charge. This is wrong. This is class warfare.
Yeah, but I think that's a very divisive thing because, of course, one very effective weapon of warfare is misinformation. And when the politicians are oversimplifying the economic realities, and at the same time, when a lot of the legislation is created behind back doors, just as your guest describes, then it's very hard to clarify the way that economic legislation gets generated in a soundbite. But if we had a more open debate where we said, quite honestly, you know, and people, there's a lot of shame about class issues in the United States as well, because people think, you know, if I don't make a lot of money, then I'm not a good person. So these things are morally tinged in a way which really makes it hard to talk about them in an honest and direct way, and I feel like that's one shortcoming of our debates about these kinds of things.
We take your point, and we appreciate your perspective there from Berlin, Cullen. Thanks very much for calling. We're going to push right on down into those details, the more subtle grain of this. Got a caller who may have an example for you to interpret, David K. Johnston. Stephen's calling from Westminster, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
I own a small business, David, that is in the lumber business. And a number of years ago, a group of about 30 sawmills got together and felt that the Canadians were getting too low a price for their wood. So they ended up putting in a countervailing duty, which was roughly 29%. Of the value of the lumber. All of the proceeds that were collected were given to these people. And I sort of think that's a little bit cute, if nothing else, on the part of the government. I ended up going to court trying to get our products brought into the country without this, because it basically almost put me out of business.
So lumber was too cheap for their tastes. They got the government to act, and as you saw it anyway, it ended up lining their pockets at your expense and maybe consumers too, Stephen.
Absolutely. In fact, most people who were building houses then had an additional cost of about $1,000 per house because of this countervailing duty. And it wasn't something that was collected by the government and kept in their treasury. It was collected for the complainants, being those 30 lumber companies, roughly.
Wow.
I find a little bit curious when I dug into it.
Curious is a nice word for that. I could think of worse. David K. Johnston, the picture you paint is of deals kind of like this one, just shot all through the American economy. Sort of put the fork in anywhere and you'll find one.
That's exactly right, Tom. And I've got example after example. That one, which I am aware of, is one that I didn't put in the book because I'm also concerned about telling a readable story to you that lays out the issues and goes forward. But government has passed all sorts of regulations and rules and laws in which, quite literally, the government collects money through a tax, a tariff, an excise, or a rule, and puts it in the pockets of a narrow group of people. And this is going on all over the place, and people do not recognize it because it's either not been covered or just covered in a way that makes no sense. For example, the sales tax we talked about earlier in the show.
Mm-hmm.
When you read news reports about it, you will read a story that says this wonderful new store is being built with help from the Economic Development Agency. It's going to create X number of jobs with tax increment financing.
Tax increment financing, okay.
Right, which means they don't pay taxes. They keep the taxes. the owners of the store. They keep the taxes. And if the news media would report these things in that way, I think you'd have a much different reaction. But one of the things that has happened that's unfortunate as the news media has shrunk has been this steady adoption of the language of the people who are being quoted rather than using your own independent language to put things into plain English for readers.
And you go right on down. It's a big list here. I mean, you're looking at wealthy golf course owners, sports stadium owners, title insurance companies, companies and sometimes folks in government who help American jobs go overseas, but not exactly purely on a market basis, with a kind of a twist and an extra dollop in the pocket when it happens.
That's right. And we've actually even endangered our national security by this. There is an entire industry. It's a small industry, but it is absolutely vital to making things like smart bombs and laser-guided missiles that the Chinese military, through fronts, bought, removed from the United States. Now, the Clinton administration allowed these fronts to buy these companies, and it was connected up with General Motors and others who were seeking favors from the Chinese government so they could sell cars and trucks over there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Clinton administration said, you can't remove this technology from the United States. It is so vital to our national defense. The Bush administration came in. The Chinese military's fronts removed this stuff from the U.S.
In other words, they moved the manufacturing to China in spite of a promise not to?
That's right. And Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana wrote to the Bush White House saying, how can this help our national security to have this vital industry be in the hands of China? And never got a reply. The White House didn't reply to me. And now we are beholden to the Chinese. If we were to get into an extended war with the Chinese, this technology would turn out to be a serious problem for us.
Never mind warfare there, just in terms of what kind of country we are. Americans have a certain self-perception. But you say if you want to look around for economic structure and distribution of income and wealth, we no longer really are like many countries with which we've historically associated ourselves. You say the United States today looks more like Mexico or Brazil or, for that matter, contemporary Russia.
Yes, those three countries and the United States, when you look at the statistical charts on wealth and income distribution among the major modern economies, are the four outliers. And they are characterized by having a rapid increase in the number of billionaires, by having a growing segment of people who are poor, and by having a middle class that is struggling. Now, that's changed somewhat in Russia because oil prices, Russia is a huge oil exporter. Mm-hmm. That's been helping Russia since the statistics I cited in the book. But the fundamental trend is the same. And in the U.S., I show that we haven't been investing in education. In fact, if it weren't for all the additional women getting graduate degrees, we would be showing a sharp drop in the number of graduate degrees we're issuing here in the United States. Well, that's our future, is the education of our most valuable asset, human minds. And we have policies that have created unbelievable, fabulous riches for student loan companies, where the government rules say you can never get out of this loan unless you die, and then if you leave an estate, it gets paid. And not unsurprisingly, Sallie Mae, the biggest student loan company, earns a profit margin three times that of commercial banks.
So there's
the profit. Government guarantees it gets paid.
Yeah, and the basic education going untended. Let's get one more call from Deborah in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah.
I believe all of this. I live it every day. And I need to know, what on God's green earth are we supposed to do about it? The vast majority of our time and energy is spent trying to scratch together the money to pay the mortgage. What can we do?
David?
Good, great question. First of all, you have to inform yourself. That's the reason I wrote Free Lunch. Secondly, you've got to say, I have to spend some of my time as a citizen asking questions, showing up and saying to my congressman and being prepared, what about this or that issue, my city council, making sure that you tell other people what you've learned. I assure you that a lot of merchants, if you read the sections about the sales tax game, will be shocked if you tell them this and unhappy, and they should be going to their chambers of commerce and other groups complaining about this kind of favoritism for the big national retailers. Fundamentally, though, democracy depends on you and me. We can't say somebody else is going to do it.
Do you feel the tide preparing, perhaps, to change with the tenor of the political conversation we see on the hustings right now, David, or not?
I hope so. I hope very much so, and I hope that people recognize that they are not powerless, because if they do, then we are giving up on the whole idea that we can govern ourselves. There's a little section in the back of the book where I talk about the meaning and the purpose of the Constitution, and nowhere does it say in the Constitution that its purpose was to make people rich. It was to give us peace, society, commonwealth, freedom, justice, liberty. That we have wealth is a byproduct of those things. And we need to get back to teaching our children and focusing on the fact that it is our liberties, our opportunities, and our commonwealth that is the purpose of our Constitution.
David K. Johnston's new book is titled Free Lunch. David, on the other side of this election, however it unfolds, we'll watch what happens and have you back for a little judgment. Thank you very much for being with us today.
I'll look forward to it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.